Adventist World Radio. From broadcast to baptism. Powered by SID Media.
Pastor Banda joined us on the line to answer your question. Mfundisi, good afternoon to you. Welcome and thank you very much for agreeing to talk to us.
Good afternoon, Nai, and greetings to everybody. Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much, Mfundisi. Yesterday, we had a conversation which we ran out of time without getting everything you would have loved to teach us yesterday. And there was a quotation you wanted to share with us, but you couldn't find it at the time. Do you have it before you right now?
Yes, I do.
All right, go ahead. Go ahead. Let's begin with that, and then we'll get into our question for today.
Okay, so three quick things. The first is found in 2 Corinthians 5, verse 18. I just want to clarify that. And that is that God calls us to a ministry of reconciliation.
Right.
So in as much as reconciliation will take a bit of time, it is still mandatory that we reconcile.
Right.
Then secondly, the quotation I got, it's basically principles that we put together from the book Ministry of Healing and then Child Guidance.
Okay.
Where Mama White puts out a point to say God never asks us to put ourselves in position of harm to prove we've forgiven.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay. All right.
Then finally, let me give you the concept of Joseph in the book of Genesis.
Yeah.
So when the brothers come to him and finally he discloses who he is in Genesis 45 verse 3, he first of all in chapter 44 runs them through a series of tests, putting money in their bags and so on and so forth. Then finally he gives them a final test in chapter 44 where he asks them to bring their youngest brother Benjamin to stay with them and remain with them as they go back.
Right.
So when the brothers refuse, he now is sure that they have reformed from their past mistake.
Right.
And so now he feels comfortable to disclose his identity to them in chapter 45.
Okay.
And at this point of disclosure, this is now where we can say he reconciles with them, even though he had already forgiven them in the past.
Okay.
So I think those can help us put everything together.
All right, Mfundis. As you can imagine, I have my questions around all these stories, but not for today. For today, I want us to pick up from today's question. Should churches require background checks for all ministry leaders, including volunteers? And I want to give you perhaps some perspective of the conversation I had with a different pastor here, and would love the benefit of your insight also. These background checks, ultimately, from where we stand as lay people, are those people who are doing background checks, those churches that do background checks, while they may be doing what the law requires of them, but the faith from where we stand is not allowing them. We as lay people see that as people digging into our past, a forgiven past. You as a church now are digging into it, are rehearsing what has already been forgiven. If somebody had committed a crime, now it seems as though these background checks are digging into people's sins that they already have served time for. And so the question is asking, should churches require background checks for all ministry leaders, including volunteers? Should there be these background checks?
The quick answer, Naye, is yes. And the concept is biblical.
Okay.
Right from the Old Testament in Deuteronomy, we find God giving instructions on the qualifications and requirements for a leader or a king, including a priest in the book of Leviticus.
Okay.
So for you to come to arrive at a point where you are sure to say this is the right person, it means you have dug their past and you have proved them worthy. In the New Testament, we find Paul speaking to his sons Timothy and Titus, and he gives them requirements for those who must be chosen as elders and deacons. He must be a man of one wife, and he must not be given to drunkenness, and so on and so forth.
Mm.
So that already requires that before we can sit down to choose somebody into this particular office, we must have dug their history and found out that they have a good reputation in the community before we can sit down and say, okay, they are right to be put in this particular office.
Right.
And further to that, just the idea of us sitting in a nominating committee and to pick out leaders to lead us also entails that we have done a background check already, because we are saying that this district pastor or the head elder or the chairperson for the committee
right.
is not able to know everybody fully for them to be able to point who is supposed to lead out.
Right.
So there needs to be people who are able to give out some information to help in the process of choosing.
Right.
Now,
right.
all of this has been happening already, except that we did not give it a tag or a title as background checks.
Right, right.
Now, what has led to this idea of giving it a tag now is because globally there is a law now that is passed where every organization must show that they have been careful in choosing people to take up leadership roles. For example, those who are going to lead over children and those who are going to lead over women and the vulnerable in society.
Right.
They must be checked, and there must be proof that the checking has been done. And so today, the church also has to do even some in-depth background check, to the extent that I think in some websites I have seen, they will even ask for police certificates that would clear somebody, for example, who is going to be a youth leader.
Right.
And
right.
this is so that should anything go wrong, at least the church could stand out to show that they did what was lawfully required of them, and that probably the error that may have happened thereafter, they may not be held accountable for being negligent as they carry out their responsibility. Otherwise, background checks have been there, even in scripture.
So what then happens when we discover that this person has been in prison? Are we not supposed to elect people who have been in prison into office?
So the idea of a background check really is not that we discriminate somebody completely from holding positions of responsibility. However, it's there to help us apply caution as we allow them to lead the children of God. And so if we know, for example, that this one has been in custody for things like child molestation or abuse in a home, then we are careful as we put them into office of responsibility. We don't bring them to a place of vulnerable people like children and women, but
right,
we put them
right.
in a different portfolio altogether.
Right. I ask this because our Bible is replete with Bible writers who were incarcerated for misleading people.
Okay.
Paul, the author of the majority of the books in the New Testament, is an ex-convict. He was incarcerated. Why?
Right.
Because he was deemed to be misleading people. And now we take a person who is known by government and the state that this person is known to mislead people, and we as a church, we follow the writings, we select his writings to be in the majority of the New Testament. We have Peter, who himself is an ex-convict. He was incarcerated, but we read his writings and we follow his leadership. He was incarcerated for misleading people. The government and the third arm of government, which is the courts, they found him guilty. He had to defend himself to no avail. John also was an ex-convict. And to top it all off, our very own main actor in this story, Yeshua ben Joseph, Yeshua HaMashiach, he too is an ex-convict. In fact, yeah, he's not even an ex-convict. He was sent to death row and he died under capital punishment. Why?
Right.
Because he too was misleading people. If then the principle you have outlined now, Mfundisi, applies, then we must just delete the entirety of the New Testament, because it is written by people and about a person who are convicts or ex-convicts. So by that standard, if we know that if you were a child molester, you are arrested and incarcerated for child molesting, we don't put you next to children. If you are arrested for thievery, we don't make you a deacon to collect offerings. If you are arrested for misleading people, we don't let you lead people because you're going to mislead us. How is it then that we are taking leadership in the New Testament from people who are ex-convicts, and some, like Jesus, are convicts who died on death row under the capital punishment.
So the case of the history of conviction for any individual, I think, is a case-by-case situation.
Okay.
And we will not be saying that when we dig up your history, then we are barring you from leadership. We want to see in which area are we going to be comfortable to put you in, where
right.
we as a church will be comfortable. But more than that, we will also be at peace with the church should anything go wrong.
Right.
Because we know that we live in a world where things can go wrong at any time. And we, as a church, we would lose hefty sums in trying to defend ourselves in a place where probably we just appear to be negligent.
Mm.
So we just want to understand, what is your history? Were you truly incarcerated for something that, for an offense that you truly committed? Or were you just wrongfully accused, like was the case for Peter, for example, who was doing the right thing but was just wrongfully accused? So
yes.
if we determine it is in that particular scenario, then we might say, okay, fine, your case is different. But if you had a case of that nature, why don't we then put you away from a place where we might be questioned for negligence and put you in a place where you can rightfully and comfortably serve without any finger pointing labeled against you? Because if fingers begin to fly against you again,
right.
we would not have helped the situation. We would have actually dampened your faith in the process when we could have helped the situation.
So we are comfortable because these were convicted, and there was never a time where their convictions were removed or withdrawn. The government has, at no point did they say, we're going to release Peter because he's innocent. We're going to release Paul because he's innocent, or John because he's innocent, or Jesus because he's innocent. The sentences that they were sentenced to were carried out. So how do we arrive at the conclusion that this person was false? Do we make our own determination against the determination of a jurist that is duly appointed?
For example, when we look at Peter's case, that should be in chapter 12 of the book of Acts.
All right.
Where for simply proclaiming the gospel, he is incarcerated together and he's just alone. And we have the church praying for him in Rhoda's home. And miraculously, the man is released from prison. And he goes right to the place where they know he knows he will find refuge. And yet he finds them praying there. So in that particular sense, the church itself already knows that this man has been arrested for unlawfully, because he is an innocent man, as it were. And so they easily admit him and have him continue with the work of God, which I believe can easily happen. It actually does happen even in our day to day. We had a case recently, not so long ago, right in SID, where some of our fellow ministers were actually arrested wrongfully in a certain country I'll not mention.
Mm.
But the church actually helped to stand up for them and defend them. And when they were released, I know, or at least I assume, that they were taken back into ministry and they continued their work, because the church understood very well after following their case that they were actually wrongfully accused.
Yeah.
So, so that is basically what is the principle that lies behind there.
All right. As usual, we really don't have time to litigate this point, but I would love to get into the various details of this, and we can deal with it, nitpick and deconstruct the various nuances and the merits of each of these cases. But we don't have time. Pastor, thank you very much for your time and your insights. We always appreciate you.
Always a blessing. Thank you so much.
You are tuned into Adventist World Radio, powered by SID Media.